This episode is brought to you by Escape Maker, hosting the Women in Food and Farming Festival on May 8th and 9th. Learn more at womennourish.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we dedicate our stories to elders, grandparents, and family members who came before us.
Some people called on the phone, "What time is your appointment?" "Mine's 2:45. Our friend, the dentist, he was 3:30. And it was like a social event.
It's a small island. A lot of them I knew when I was a kid. So it was, you know, to really help them feel like they weren't alone.
It's partly this communal nature of food. And so it can operate as a bridge, not just between neighbors and friends, but also between the living and the dead.
Listen to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes of Feast Your Ears can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd love it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. For those of you with kids at home, I'd like to be so bold as to suggest you check out my other podcast here on Heritage Radio Network. Along with my co-host, Hannah Forden, the program manager at HRN, we've created Time for Lunch, a fun food-focused show for kids. We'd love it if you check it out wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also like to remind listeners that Heritage Radio is a nonprofit, and we need your help to stay on the air. If you enjoy this show and listen to the other great podcasts we produce every week, please find your way to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make your gift. Today's theme, kimchi fridges and ramen hacks. I know we all live similar lives, eating, sleeping, working, and on the most basic level, all people need the same things. Food, compassion, rest, love, water, shelter. Over the millennia, humans have figured out myriad ways to get and deliver these things based on where they live, what is available, and who is around them. It's an evolution that we're all a small part of every day, every month, every year, every lifetime. What are some things that you do that you learned from your parents or your grandparents or your children? What are some things that you hope your kids or siblings will remember having learned from you and pass on to others? These are the things that we sometimes take for granted. Some are small, like leave the toilet seat down or hold the door open for the next person, and some are more impactful, like how to find drinkable water or survive in the woods. My guest today has a few of these to share with you, so listen up. And maybe we can all end up with a kimchi fridge and more delicious ramyun for lunch.
Hi, I'm Peter. I guess I work in food culture and food content. I'm at Pinterest right now, heading up food there. And then before that, I spent almost a decade starting something called the Museum of Food and Drink. And I am passionate about food. I'm passionate about culture. I'm passionate about the arts. I'm passionate especially about music among the arts. And so those are really the things that make my world go around.
Awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, we first met, I think, back when MOFAD was just like, you know, like the tiniest spark of an idea before there was before there was any of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I started working on MOFAD in 2011, but while I was still working, I had a full-time job, and then I quit and I started working full-time on MOFAD in May 2012. And, you know, we started with like no money, really barely any team. It was me and a few other volunteers. And it was we're gonna start this museum that has, you know, the likes of which have never been seen before. And it's going to have exhibitions where you can actually eat what you're learning about. And you'll learn about flavor science. And you'll learn about, you know, compelling cultural stories and all sorts of things. And at that time, it really felt like pie in the sky, kind of like wave a magic wand and imagine it. But then, you know, eventually we got there. And yeah. I mean, there's still a long way to go still for the museum, but, you know.
For sure.
I feel like really proud about how far we went.
Yeah. I mean, the Louvre had to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. That's right.
I mean.
Well, let me just caveat that by saying, in my research on how museums get started, the vast majority of major cultural museums, and I'm not talking about the small sort of like, you know, old house that's been renovated in some like, you know, historic location.
Sure.
They, like a big like cultural museum, like the Louvre or the Met or MoMA. They all pretty much got their start from with wealthy benefactors who just had a collection and money to really get things going.
Sure.
The idea of sort of bootstrapping museum and getting it up to that scale is actually, there's not a lot of precedent for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to say, I mean, I love what you did in starting MOFAD. I think it was an incredible idea. I think the execution was so cool because it was like, you know, cultural institution museum meets science museum. I mean, I remember the very first, you know, the very first display of the puffing gun, where I actually thought you might die when you were releasing the pressure in that insane contraption.
Oh yeah, well, yeah. So that's the thing you're referring to is the Puritan puffing gun. It's a breakfast cereal cannon, essentially.
Yep.
Technology that dates back to the 30s. And yeah, well, we found the manufacturer who had originally made this thing and got it shipped over and opened up the crate. And there it was, this machine that's like built to 1930s era specifications, no instruction manual or anything, and just sort of figured out how to like make it explode cereal. And of course, I was the lucky schmuck who got to fire the thing for the first time and mostly fired after that.
Well, luckily yeah. You still have all 10 fingers, right?
Yeah, luckily.
Awesome. So while we're on the subject of museums, since you clearly, I mean, you know, in starting a museum, did a ton of research, I'm sure you went to like an innumerable number of museums. Were there any museums that you saw or came across in your research that you were just like, oh, that is such a cool museum? I have one in mind, but I'm curious to hear what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I would say MOFAD really drew heavily on museums that I and my colleagues in the project really were inspired by. And to give you a smattering of the ones we liked, one is the Tenement Museum. Mm. I mean, in terms of something that's immersive and takes you into the story, I mean, really, you can't beat the Tenement Museum.
Yeah.
And then in terms of just sheer wonder and interactivity and a sense of play, the Exploratorium in San Francisco. And then in terms of just sheer breadth, which is like something that it was kind of a North Star for us where we want to end up with MOFAD, it's really the Met. You know, I mean, the Met you can go to and you just lose yourself in just exploring all of the world's history and all of the world's, wonder. And it's such an amazing place. So, yeah, I mean, we had a lot of museums that inspired us. I would say like the Museum of the Moving Image was one that personally I thought was a really clever museum.
Yep.
But yeah, I can keep going.
Yeah. I mean, the two that come to mind for me, two like museums that I think of, and I love museums. I try to go to museums anywhere I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't know if it's still there, but back when I was a teenager in the early 90s, the Museum of Television and Radio in New York was super cool. Because they had a listening library before YouTube and before stuff was on the internet, you could go there and sit at a booth and like scroll through this computer terminal with just like a, you know, a black and white screen that was green. And you could just put in and be like, I want to watch Sesame Street episode 3.
Yeah.
And you could watch it or you could listen to radio shows. That I thought was really cool from an interactive perspective. And in Tokyo, there is a museum of tobacco and salt.
Uh-huh.
I don't know specifically why those two things were chosen. I don't know if it has to do with like production or importation or whatever, but basically it's like an 8-floor building and every other floor is about one of those two things. So like the top floor is about tobacco and the 7th floor is about salt and the 6th floor is about tobacco and the 5th floor is about salt. And you like start at the top and work your way down.
That's so interesting.
It's super interesting. And it has like, I mean, and some of it's like interactive and then there's like just like these giant cases filled with every cigarette package you could possibly ever imagine from all over the world.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah. Anyway.
That is wild. I'm trying to understand the through line between tobacco and salt, but yeah, I guess.
They both get dried? I don't know.
Yes. Oh man.
Not really sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, you know, after starting MOFAD and shepherding it in its first iteration, you've now moved on. And so what do you do at Pinterest?
So yeah, I head up our work with food creators and food content. And so Pinterest right now is making a bit of a change in direction. And so I don't know if you use Pinterest, but Pinterest has traditionally been, it's always been a place for ideas and inspiration. So, you know, when you go to Pinterest, it's like, you're not going there just to sort of see people taking selfie pictures, right, or like, you know, whatever. It's actually, you're going because you're planning to do something, whether you're planning a wedding, you're planning a meal, you're planning a trip, you're planning a home renovation project. And Pinterest ideally is a place you go for those ideas.
It always has seemed to me to be very visually based, like storyboard or mood board.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's a visual search engine where you can find ideas and inspiration. And that's something that, you know, I can get behind, which is why I'm, you know, happy to be working there.
Yeah.
The change is that in the past, it's always been about idea curation. So you find ideas on the web or within Pinterest, and then you pin them onto boards, along, you know, projects that you're working on. And then you can organize your thoughts that way. Now we're making a switch towards native content creation. That's to say, being able to generate your own ideas within Pinterest and then share them.
Mm.
And so it's another layer. And what it means is we have to then think about what kind of content do we want people creating? What kind of creators do we want people coming on to sort of show the way? And so that's really where I'm at. I'm at that sort of tip of the spear of shaping what food content that is created on Pinterest looks like, and then what kind of people we want on the platform. And that includes both, like, you know, high-end people who are like famous, and then also thinking about how we can work with a lot of smaller scale creators and help them, you know, share their ideas.
Right. Right. Very cool. And then, yeah. and how does that tie into food? Like, is it a space for sharing recipes or ingredient ideas?
Oh yeah, actually, food is, I think, the top use case for Pinterest. It's people go there for recipes. I would say I'm not surprised that you wouldn't know that, because it's not right now configured for a more like advanced level cook.
Sure.
But a lot of people use it for recipes, but it's, you know, to date, it's been more kind of just like very entry level accessible recipes for the casual home cook.
Got it.
Which is, you know, most people. But yeah, I think like I'm excited about also helping to sort of build a pipeline of content on there where, like, as you grow in your own sort of cooking development, like being able to find more and more advanced content on the platform.
Totally. So I have to ask, you know, when you're working in that kind of realm where you're kind of pushing something forward, right, in a, mm-hmm. in a technology and social media kind of way, do you think about like your son as a use case for that? I mean, I know he's really little, but.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I do. I mean, I think, yeah, you know, I think the thing I like about it is, the ultimate metric of success with this, and this is why I can kind of get behind Pinterest, is that, is like, are people actually using the content to do things in real life?
Yep.
Right. And so, if, you know, if I can make our food content something that's really inspirational, also really inclusive, we're telling the right stories alongside the recipes, because I think, you know, recipes in isolation without some storytelling is lacking something.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, and I certainly think at the same time about my kid, Felix, and like, he's, you know, almost 3 years old, already in the kitchen with me. But, you know, I want him to be able to find ideas and to be able to, to dive into the whole world of cooking. And so certainly I think about people like him. But, you know, really, because the universe for Pinterest is so big, we have 450 million people who use it.
Wow.
It's really like wearing a lot of different hats and thinking about, what is Gen Z looking for? Mm. What are like older folks looking for? Are we making sure this is accessible for people of every different sort of cultural background?
Right.
It's a lot of lenses.
So I want to talk a little bit actually about cultural backgrounds. People who are listening, because they can't see us, may not realize or may not know that you are Korean American. And
right.
I want to talk about what that was like growing up. What your parents came to the United States from Korea?
Yeah, that's right. So my parents both came separately. They didn't know each other at the time, in the 60s, early 60s, to the U.S. My dad went to Auburn. He came to do a master's degree. And then my mom was in Philly, and she came to as part of some exchange program with hospitals to work at a U.S. hospital.
Hmm. And then they decided to stay? They liked the United States?
You know what? I honestly, I think they were just coming from pretty difficult starting places. I mean, both of them had their families sort of torn apart by the Korean War.
Got it.
So on both sides, their families kind of pulled together the money to send them to the U.S. on one-way tickets. And so I think there's a pretty high barrier to going back at that point.
Sure.
So you're kind of just in it to, like, you're in the pool, you know? And so they came, I mean, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing to think about this, but it's a time when, it, you know, flying was a common, you know, everyday thing.
And they,
they flew one way to the U.S., not much money, without really any easy way to get more money, and then without knowing anybody in the U.S., just showing up, and with varying degrees of English. My dad, not so good. My mom, much better. But my mom was like, I think 18, 19, or like maybe 20 years old when she came. And so, you know, they, it's kind of crazy to think about that. There's no real equivalent to that in my life. I mean, I never had to take such a bold, crazy move.
Right, right. I mean, and I feel like it's something that is pretty far from a lot of people. Right. The idea that you would have to leave your home. I mean, not it's not foreign to a lot of people worldwide. There are refugees and people who have to do this all over the place. But I think certainly in modern America, those stories are not, you don't find that a lot. And so it's definitely interesting. And so then they landed. You grew up in the Midwest, right?
Yeah. So there's a whole crazy love story with my mom and dad, which I won't get into. But they they met on a blind date, and then my dad had a then they got married, and my dad got a job as an engineer. My dad was like a dishwasher until he got a job as an engineer, and he will always talk about like the times working as a dishwasher in New York City. But then he got a job as an engineer in New Jersey, then in Minnesota. And then in Illinois, and that's, you know, the family moved along with that.
Right.
And so he got a job at a heating and cooling company, which had an office in Danville, Illinois, which is in like east central Illinois, pretty much like vertically in the center of Illinois and the right on the east side of it.
Got it.
Totally flat area of the country.
Yep.
And yeah, and then that's where I was born.
And I mean, growing up, was it hard for your parents to kind of keep Korean traditions alive in the house? I mean, were Korean ingredients and things, was there a Korean community in Danville?
There was a small Korean community, which was united by Korean church.
Yep.
And that's how everybody saw each other. And in terms of ingredients, you know, you make do with what you have, of course. So my mom, you know, sometimes would make kimchi with like normal cabbage and not Napa cabbage, and then as an example. But then there was a decent-sized Korean community in Champaign, Illinois, where the University of Illinois is, and then a large Korean community in Chicago. And so for like small things, we would go to Champaign to get some Korean ingredients. And then for like once in a while, we'd do like a big trip to Chicago with like our coolers, and then like lug everything back all the way back down. So like a 3-hour trip there, 3-hour trip back. That's how we get like our like bulk like Korean grocery fix.
Right. And then, you know, are you continuing those traditions for your son? Like, is Felix, like, does he know how to make kimchi yet?
You know, I haven't made kimchi with him yet, but he has eaten kimchi.
Sure.
I have to like rinse it for him, but he does like it. He, you know, it's funny, and you maybe have observed this as well, but like when while my wife was pregnant with Felix, you know, I really made sure that she ate kimchi and like other kinds of like sour cabbagey things along the way while she was pregnant with him, and also while breastfeeding. And like he, it's like, I don't know if I can call it total causality, but like he loves sour cabbage of any sort. So
nice.
If I just take shredded cabbage and pour vinegar on it, he will just inhale it. He loves it. So, I was like, yeah, mission accomplished. And yeah, I mean, I can totally see echoes of what she likes to eat. My wife is French. So, you know, he does love like smelly cheese.
Right.
And he likes his like sour cabbage. So yeah, that worked out.
So do you think that, you know, do you think that he'll go through, you know, we haven't talked yet about Counter Jam, your your podcast, but on your first episode there, you talked about growing up Korean American with Roy Choi and with Margaret Cho, and you guys talked about getting food shamed and stuff, and having a separate fridge for your stinky kimchi. It sounds like you've set your son up to be shamed both for stinky cheese and for kimchi.
Yes, I guess so. Although I think now. A few things. I think there's a cultural shift now that's happened since when I was a kid, where there's a greater acceptance, especially look, I was in Nowhereville, USA before. And then now I'm in New York City. Yeah. And so in Brooklyn, if you're not eating kimchi, it's at least among a certain,
right.
I don't want to be overbroad here, among a certain set. Yes. Of well-to-do Brooklynites, and I would say I fall within that, for better or for worse. I think I also think that I feel I'll be better equipped to help him navigate his identity, in terms of his being French and Korean, but also American.
Yep.
When I was growing up in the Midwest, I think, there's a lot of conflict between trying to reconcile my home identity with my Koreanness and then, the wanting to fit in with the prevailing sort of what I perceive to be as American,
sure.
Which of course I was American, but a lot of times when you think yourself as an outsider, you call the other people American and yourself not American,
right.
Which is kind of messed up.
Yeah, totally.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Maker, hosting the Women in Food and Farming Festival. This Mother's Day weekend, May 8th and 9th, EscapeMaker.com will present the first annual Women in Food and Farming Festival at Stone Ridge Orchard in New York's Hudson Valley. That's just 2 hours outside of New York City in Ulster County. The two-day hybrid live and virtual event, open to the public, will honor and celebrate women-owned businesses in the food, farm, and craft beverage spaces and provide entrepreneur resources. A live farmers market on May 8th will host dozens of women farmers and craft beverage and food producers, with products ranging from cakes and cookies to fresh veggies and honey to hot sauces and teas, all locally sourced and produced. For those not able to attend in person, there will be a virtual experience on May 9th. It will include 25 online tours, demos, and educational presentations on various topics on demand for the public and trade. Learn more at womennourish.com.
So let's talk about Counter Jam. Counter Jam is your podcast with Food 52.
That's right.
I've been listening. It's great. So tell me about the sort of genesis of it. How did it come about? And, I don't know. I bet you're having fun doing it. It sounds like it's a really fun time to make.
Oh, thank you so much, Harry. So I've had the good fortune of living in a lot of different countries and also just traveling a fair amount. And wherever I've gone, the way I've always connected with people was through food and music. I think I've had a realization over the course of my life of just food and music being these incredibly universal things where even if you have no common language, you yep. can connect over those two things.
Absolutely.
I can hear a song from a culture that I don't understand at all and really appreciate just the musical composition of the song, the mood of it, and how it makes me feel. It's a universal language. I mean, it's cliche to say that, but it's absolutely right. And it is a language, you're using notes to communicate an idea or a feeling. And then on top of that, I'm also, I'm a food guy, of course. So I cook all the time and I love food. And obviously, started a museum for food. So that's beyond doubt. But I'm also really a music guy. I've played music ever since I was a kid. So I did violin and piano when I was a kid. Once I could decide what instrument I wanted to play, I did guitar. I was in an a cappella group in college, which sometimes I like to sweep under the rug. I picked up learning how to MC, and then I started producing beats and DJing, and then later got back into guitar and started playing flamenco guitar. And so I have a voracious appetite for all things food and music. And so I was really trying to think about always looking on the lookout for a project that could bring those two things together. And that's what Counter Jam is. You know, I realized, okay, we can look at culture and look at it through the lens of food and music. And it will be almost like the podcast version of the ultimate dinner party, you know, right. Of like good stories, good food, good music. And yeah, so the format of the show is every episode looks at one cultural identity. And we talk to, you know, I talk to two or three people who are from that community. And we talk primarily about the food, but also really just generally, you know, what the food reflects.
Yeah.
And then there's a soundtrack on every episode of music by artists from that community. And so over the course of the episode, what I'd say is I'd consider the people and the music to be kind of like data points on this identity. It's like not the final word on like what, like the first episode's on Korean American. Talking to Margaret Cho, my mom, and Roy Choi is not like, and like listening to music by three different Korean American artists, it's not like you're getting a complete picture of what it's like to be Korean American, but you're getting like five or six data points of like perspectives on the identity.
Yep.
And I feel like, you know, ultimately I want people to have fun listening to it, but I also want people to be able to kind of put themselves in the shoes of that identity and, you know, hopefully drive listeners further into like on a path towards understanding and empathy and caring and connection, which I think, you know, we all need as much of as we can right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and I think the show from the episodes that I've listened to, you know, does a very good job of that. I mean, I love the idea of thinking about, you know, like how could you incorporate these things? I was like, you know, when I heard the idea of having an entire kimchi fridge, I was like, that is genius. I want an entire refrigerator to keep my fermentation in. Like, why didn't I think of that? My fridge is like every corner of it has like little ferments in it. I'm like, I should just get another refrigerator. That's so smart.
Yep, that's right. And I think like these are things that like for any, you ask any Korean American about a kimchi fridge and it's like, zero hesitation. We'd all know what we're talking about.
Right.
And then, but somebody who's not, it's like, that's our reality. But then you know, talk to somebody who's not from that and it's like, oh, what? And like that happens, you know, I knew that because that's my identity.
Yeah.
But what's been fun is going into each of these different cultures. And, it's like, you know, I the last episode, which is actually my favorite of the first season, is on Nigerian, culture.
Mm.
And we talk about cutting vegetables in your hand. And and like I lived in Cameroon and I saw this all the time where people would cut vegetables in their hand above the pot because there were just no cutting boards.
Sure.
In like rural Cameroon. And one of my guests, Ego Wodim, who's a comedian on Saturday Night Live, she said for the longest time in her life, she thought you just cut vegetables in your hand because that's how her mom did it.
Sure.
And at some point her friends called her out on it and said, don't you want to use a cutting board? And I bet you that anybody who's a child of Nigerian immigrants would hear that and be like, yep, like my parents cut vegetables in their hands.
Yeah.
And like makes sense. But for somebody who's not from there, you're like, what? Like,
right.
Why?
Right. Yeah, I mean, so interesting. And I mean, yeah, it's a cultural connection, but it also sometimes, honestly, like I feel like it might make sense. I mean, I remember my grandmother used to cut potatoes into the boiling water over the pot.
Yeah.
Like she did, the potato was big enough, the chunks were big enough. She would just do it with a paring knife and she wouldn't use a cutting board either. So like, I think there's something to be said for also learning from that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about your time in Africa because, you know, at least from, you know, what I know about you and from seeing the stuff you post and the music that you're into, Africa had a really big impact on you.
Yeah, so, you know, I think, so I did the Peace Corps in Cameroon, which is, if you look at a map of Africa, it's right in that sort of armpit. And so it's at the crossroads between West and Central Africa.
Mm.
I knew nothing about Cameroon, let alone West Africa or Central Africa, let alone like Africa before going. And I was like 22 years old when I went out there. And yeah, I mean, I did public health work. And I mean, this is like way more than I could get into in this interview, but
sure.
Suffice it to say that, a lot. I went in bright eyed and like optimistic and thinking I could like, you know, make a difference. And then I quickly realized like I was there to learn, really. And so, you know, I did little things to support the community I was in. I was in a rural village with like no running water, no electricity, but I would say most of my effort was spent understanding the culture and adapting to it, and learning. And then, you know, I had a lot of really intense experiences there. And I would say that it was like probably the most sort of formative adult experience of my lifetime, of just like learning stuff like all the time. I mean, there's like a level of self-reliance that came out of that was reflective of the level of self-reliance of people generally there,
right?
That continues to inform how I live today.
Sure.
So yeah.
Sure. I want to touch on what might be kind of like a somewhat difficult subject. You know, we've gone through an insane year, not just with COVID, but with the Black Lives Matter movement. And do you think that we're now approaching like a BLM moment for Asian Americans as well? Because we are seeing a huge uptick in violence against Asian Americans. And I'm just curious to know if, you know, is that something that is, you know, I'm not Asian American, so I wanted to ask you what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I think it's interesting talking to other Asian Americans. I think a lot of us are really like having a hard time even reconfiguring our brains to understanding ourselves that we warrant care and empathy. And like, we're so used to like having this problem be invisible and like discounted. And yet it's so real. Like I could give you stories of like, you know, harassment that I've faced for being Asian American, but you know, you don't really talk about it. And so, for it to now be like an issue, I think certainly there are a lot of Asian Americans who are like mobilizing, but I think there's like, honestly, and even for myself, I have to admit, it's hard for me to kind of like bring my brain around to be like, wait, like we should like mobilize for ourselves too, you know, like right. It's kind of like crazy. I don't know. It's like you just kind of like stuff it down inside and then don't like really, and I don't know. It's hard to explain.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's also hard because if you don't experience it and you don't see it happening yourself, I think it's very easy. I mean, having lived in New York for a very long time, I saw things happen once in a while in New York that were either racist or, you know, hateful against different groups. But it was honestly, I feel like, pretty rare in New York that I would come across that, because I felt like New York was kind of, you know, I mean, at least in the places I ended up, was very much a melting pot. And I never felt weird walking down the street in the South Bronx or in Chinatown or in any neighborhoods. And I didn't see a lot of, you know, I felt like we're all there. Like we're all New Yorkers.
Yeah,
we're all riding the subway. We're all walking down the street. And then to hear about these things happening both in New York and in other places is pretty intense. And so I just, you know, I wanted to bring it up because I think it's important that we talk about it. And I think it's important that people recognize it and also call it out when they see it and do something about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's real. Like, I mean, like a month ago, I had somebody on the streets accuse me of kidnapping my own child.
Whoa.
And he like got up in my face and was like asking me for proof that was my kid, because my kid is like has blonde hair. I mean, his mom is French. And
right.
So like, yeah, I mean, it ended with going to the police station. That was the only way that we could like resolve that. Yeah.
Gosh.
And like, you know, it was just such a weird experience. But like, yeah, I mean that.
Wow.
You know, that happened. That just happened like that was like a month ago. So
Yeah, I mean, that's very overt, you know.
Yeah.
And I think there are less overt ways. I interviewed two Asian American women who actually. Well, they live in America now. They were actually born in Malaysia, but who run Coffee Project New York, who said that when they opened their first coffee shop, people would come in and see two Asian women behind the counter and turn around and leave.
Right. Yeah.
Like, because they didn't, you know, the expectation of a fancy coffee shop was, I guess, I don't know, like a guy with a mustache and a, you know,
right.
suspenders or something. But you know, they're award-winning baristas, so anyway, if there's anything that that people can do, I guess it's just to be on the lookout for that and to, you know, try to be better about not allowing that kind of, you know, rhetoric and hate into our lives.
Absolutely.
I wanted to talk a little bit about comfort food.
Yes.
So, you know, I asked you what your favorite lunch is, and you said instant ramen. And I had heard you talk with Roy Choi about sort of the a vast array of different instant ramen, or I guess in Korean it's ramyun. Is that right?
Yep, ramyun. Yep.
So you know, I was recently at the Asian grocery and was looking at the vast variety. I mean, you know, for people who think that like cup of noodle is the only one, there's an entire world out there for you to explore. Everything from like Indonesian and Malaysian to Japanese to Korean to Chinese, I mean, everything under the sun. So I wanted to hear from you, like, are you like a purist? Do you eat just what's in the package? Do you add like vegetables and egg and meat? Like, how do you like to eat yours?
Oh yeah. Well, I couldn't even say this one way, but I mean, I think of instant ramen and just generally instant ramen and more broadly, really as a canvas. And so I would say I almost never eat it just as it is in the packet. Mm. The only one I would eat on its own the way it is cup noodles, because I think it's just inherently supposed to be about, you're like kind of fighting the tide if you're like trying to like fancy up your cup noodles.
Sure.
Because the whole point of the cup noodle is like it's, if you're going to do that work, just get the package and Google, right?
Right. The cup noodle is self-contained, so you could like walk down the street with it, right?
Exactly.
The rest of it, you have to at least like put water in a pot.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, at a minimum, egg. But like, I think, I don't even know like how much time we have for this really. But like, I have a whole like flowchart, like tree of like possibilities for like how you can like hack your instant ramen. Yeah, I mean, it's like everything from, you just go component by component and everything, there's like things you can do. Like you can make the broth creamy or fatty. Just dropping like a knob of butter into your instant ramen will like really make it incredibly delicious. Or you can add like a nut butter or a miso. You could add tahini. Then there's like all kind of veg you can add. And then of course there's like dumplings you can add. You can add meats. You can add, then there's the egg. And then there's like, there's just like a whole world of possibilities for what you can do with your instant ramen. And I mean, at the end of the day, I never go make it too elaborate because it's like, again, you know,
it's a fast meal.
It's a quick thing. Yeah. But I love instant ramen.
I mean, you're setting my brain in motion about like lunch will not ever be the same when I'm working from home, I don't think, because the idea of like taking a couple of frozen dumplings and a little bit of tahini or miso and adding an egg and adding, like, totally you're going to change my life. Thank you.
Oh yeah, of course. And like all those things you said take no time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like I have like the bag of frozen dumplings and then those are the first things that go in and you let those like simmer for a second before you drop the noodles in, and then you know everything else just drops right in. It's easy.
So can we find your instant ramyun flowchart on Pinterest?
Yeah, you know what, I actually need, I am gonna develop this a bit more. I have to admit there was like there's like a book idea in there that I may or may not act on.
Sure.
But well, I guess somebody could do it now. But
no, it should be you. Yeah. You can do it. Still your idea, Peter.
One day I'm gonna create some kind of manifesto for this.
Awesome. So on the heels of that, I think one more question, which is, I had asked you in sort of a pre-show questionnaire if you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be? And you said Jesus.
Yes.
And so I guess sort of a two-parter, like, do you have a relationship now with the church, but also would you feed Jesus instant ramyun, and what do you think he would say about it?
No, I am not religious. I don't know what I am. I'm a humanist, I guess. But sure. First of all, in a question where it's like you can meet with anybody, certainly I pick a historical figure, because that is like, why not? You know, if you can be with anybody, then like pick somebody. And then if you think back, like who's the most historically significant person that you'd want to like just sort of understand? And I think like Jesus is pretty high up there.
Sure.
I would love to, and I would want to like record the conversation with Jesus, because I think maybe he could clear up some things today.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear what he has to say on Counter Jam.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And I don't know what he'd be like, but I bet you he would like, I bet you he would like instant ramen. I mean, it's like an umami rich, like soupy, like noodle thing. Like what's not to like about it? I mean, it depends on whether he likes his spice, his, you know, food spicy, but, probably not, because, that was before the Colombian exchange and
right.
there were no hot peppers where he is. So I'd have to probably do some kind of like non-spicy version, but yeah, no, I'd chill with Jesus, like, drink some whatever ale and then like, you know, hang around and
I mean, the guy who turned ramen. Water into wine probably is going to love instant ramen, right?
Yeah, yeah, I would say so. And then I can turn his wine into Pete after that.
Nice. well, Peter, it's been a real pleasure. I wanted to ask if is there anything else coming up, or, you know, like who's coming up in season 2 on Counter Jam? Can you give us a little preview?
Yes, yes. So the first episode, I'm really excited about season 2. So the first episode of season 2 is going to be looking at Jewish American, appropriately enough, identity. And
that's me.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. and I have two guests. One is Eitan Bernath, who is this like meteoric TikTok star who is 18 years old. And he, I would say, defies, I think, what your stereotypical perception of like a TikTok star might be like. I mean, he's actually like, he's incredibly thoughtful, really bright, knows way too much about food. Hmm. And so he's on. And then Ilana Glazer, who's like, you know, obviously been done a lot for like reframing how people understand Jewish American identity just through her work on Broad City.
Yep.
So that's going to be kicking off. And the music for that is amazing. I found a musician who is Jewish American who does surf rock. And I have a big soft spot for surf rock. And so I'm just really excited to have that on the show, too.
Amazing. I will leave you with I'm going to have to see if I can find it. But many, many years ago, there was a This American Life piece about a Hasidic rock and roller named Curly Oxide.
Oh, nice.
I don't know if you know this story or not.
No.
A friend of mine had befriended him years ago and made a bunch of recordings, and then they did this American Life thing. But I think because he went back into the fold of Hasidim, I think it got scrubbed.
You had the Hasidic rocker.
Yeah, and I can tell you a lot more, not on the radio, about the story of it, because I do know some of the details, but I don't think his family doesn't want those shared, as far as I understand it.
Okay, nice.
So, anyway, it's been really awesome to chat today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks, Harry.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can follow what Peter is up to on social media at PeterJKim_ or at PeterJK.com. And you can tune in to Counterjam wherever you get your podcasts or at counterjam.food52.com. It's a great show. I like to listen while I make dinner. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please reach out if you have any questions. You can reach me on email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. Feast Your Ears is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.